This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. In March of 2022, the BBC Music Magazine interviewed Belgian clarinetist Annelien van Wouwe. The Belgian clarinetist's love of yoga is the inspiration for a new album of Mozart and Hendrix, recorded just days before the birth of her son, as she tells Kate Wakeling. There's this huge cliché that people think you just sit on a mat and say om and forget about everything. But a huge part of yoga is actually about life force, explains the clarinetist Annelien van Wouwe. Life force is certainly not something this dynamic musician is short of. A sought-after concerto soloist and former BBC New Generation artist, van Wouwe also runs two acclaimed chamber ensembles and is the recipient of numerous accolades, including the prestigious Opus Classic Award for Best Young Artist in 2020. But the way she keeps 2 feet on the floor is through a decade's experience of yoga, something her new album Flow explores to beautiful effect. Born in Hama, Belgium, van Wouwe wasn't brought up in a musical family. Her father was a lawyer and her mother a writer. But her aptitude was soon clear. "Apparently I was always singing to myself." So her parents sent her to music school, where her talent quickly blossomed. Van Wouwe laughs that her attraction to the clarinet as a child was largely down to its appearance. "I just liked how it looked, the silvery keys especially." Now the instrument feels special to her because you can copy your own voice. "That has always been my approach, at first unconsciously and now very consciously. Whatever you feel inside, you can express through your voice, and the clarinet can imitate that." Nurturing the connection between one's inner life, physicality, and creative expression is key to van Wouwe's music making, not least through the links she has discovered between clarinet playing and yoga practice. She first encountered yoga while studying at the Hochschule für Musik Hans Eisler Berlin. The conservatory offered all kinds of physical courses like Alexander technique and yoga, and I tried the whole range. She soon realized that there were special benefits to combining her rigorous practice schedule with yoga. "I started to notice the huge difference it made to my clarinet playing. My breathing got better, my air support, all the things that clarinet teachers try to explain using complicated words. But through yoga, you start to feel this body consciousness for yourself." Flow, van Wouwe's new album recorded with the NDR Radio Philharmonie and conducted by Andrew Manze, offers a summation of this holistic approach to the clarinet. Released on the 31st of March on Pentatone, the disc pairs Mozart's clarinet concerto with a substantial new work, Sutra, by Flemish composer Wim Hendrix, a co-commission by the Borletti Buitoni Trust and BBC Radio 3 for solo clarinet, orchestra, and electronics, exploring the principles of yoga. Aptly enough, van Wouwe had the idea for Sutra during a yoga class. "I was resting at the end of a session and there was music playing, some beautiful mantras. There was something about listening to this while the body slowed down that felt very special. I thought, wow, we need a new piece. It didn't take Van Wouwe long to decide that Hendrix was the right composer for the task. Well known for his works drawing on Eastern philosophies, including his substantial tantric cycle, Hendrix has often incorporated other art forms into his music, and his works share an affinity with Ligeti, not least in their use of complex polyrhythms and innovative musical textures. Sutra is inspired by the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, a collection of some 200 short texts on the theory and practice of yoga dating from the early centuries CE. Van Wouwe selected the 4 sutras, or threads, from the collection, which Hendrix in turn used to shape and color his composition's 4 movements. And the resulting score is by turns luminously meditative and ferociously energetic. The work manages to circumvent some of the thornier questions of musical appropriation by exploring these yogic principles through Western contemporary classical idioms rather than an Orientalist recreation of Indian sound worlds. Sutra is also a far cry from Western New Age background music. I wasn't looking for a piece of 15-minute background music for a meditation session, confirms Van Wouwe. The first movement, Pranayama, is all about the breath waking up, so after a quiet introduction, the score has these explosive outbursts, and then the third movement is also extremely rhythmic. At points, it feels like playing the Rite of Spring. As well as being virtuosically demanding for both soloist and ensemble, the score, at Van Wouwe's request, requires each player to breathe audibly and chant in Sanskrit. It took a little while, she recalls, for the orchestra to warm up to this idea. When we did the recording, I played from the middle of the woodwind section, so I could hear them saying, Ghosh Prana, what? How do you pronounce that? It was a bit awkward, but I had to sing in the piece too, and I felt the orchestra start to think, this is our soloist, but she's also a human being. Everyone began to loosen up, and by the end, the orchestral musicians had become very convincing mantra speakers. Van Wouwe talks warmly of how her yoga practice also shaped her approach to learning sutra, not least as she began working on it when already 6 months pregnant, and somewhat staggeringly finished recording the piece in just 4 days before her son was born. It was crazy, but I think that it made it even more special because I couldn't practice for hours a day. I had to work with my body, so the piece became a kind of companion throughout the last 3 months of the pregnancy. Every day I'd think, okay, good morning, how are we going to do this? If I had a moment to play, I was forced to use as little energy as possible to really get it right. Van Wouwe performs both Sutra and the Mozart on the Bassett clarinet, similar to the standard B-flat clarinet, but with additional keys that allow it to play extra lower notes. The Bassett clarinet is closely associated with Anton Stadler, the virtuoso for whom Mozart's clarinet concerto was composed. Van Wouwe is thrilled Hendrix scored Sutra for the Bassett clarinet, too. I think it is so important to have more pieces for the instrument. And, of course, it's a connector to the Mozart. I really like that we have the old and the very modern on one album. Van Wouwe's lyrical interpretation of the Mozart conveys both effortless elegance and emotional depth, and the concerto's blend of simplicity and complexity strongly appeals to her. It's the concerto you grow up with as a clarinetist, so I always used to think, oh my goodness, soloists who play it for their entire life surely get bored of it. But actually, it's the opposite. It's such a challenging piece because you can always go further in terms of detail. It invites a perfectionist approach. There's not one note that doesn't have a meaning. Von Wawa takes this perfectionist approach into every aspect of her professional life. As the founder of the Brussels-based Carousel Chamber Ensemble and Breeze Quintet, she has considered all facets of their concert presentation, and both groups now perform in gorgeously tailored, vividly coordinated outfits from top to toe. I don't really know where it came from that musicians are supposed to wear black and white, or the same clothes you see in Downton Abbey, especially if you want to attract younger audiences. The sound my ensembles make isn't black and white. It's all the colors. So I told the players we wouldn't wear black and white, not even socks. And somehow I ended up ordering colorful socks for everybody. That's the perfectionist in me. In turn, the energy and drive that Von Wawa brings to every side of her career is inspiring. People say I'm organized, but I only do what I love. I wouldn't be happy if I didn't have enough variation. In the face of COVID lockdowns, she has arranged numerous streamed performances for her ensembles, recorded a hit series of YouTube yoga-inspired warm-up videos for clarinetists, and I keep practicing. I missed the connection to the audience, but this wasn't a reason to stop playing. Yoga has been vital in helping her keep connected, at least to myself. Despite the world turning upside down and working on sutra was like a light. Indeed, while Von Wawa is a warmly down-to-earth person, she wonders about the almost mystic good fortune that allowed Flow to be recorded amid numerous challenges. We had to change so many dates, and when we came to the last part of the recording, it was the very last chance, both for me in terms of the pregnancy, but also for the orchestra. 2 days after we finished recording, there was a lockdown in Germany. I'm not very spiritual, but I thought, this cannot be a coincidence. Somehow it all just fell into place. The December 2023 issue of the BBC Music Magazine has an article by Ashutosh Khandelwal. He explains why Maria Callas has remained such a powerful influence on fans and singers. This woman is a miracle. Elizabeth Schwarzkopf's exclamation still resonates a century after Maria Callas's birth, celebrated this December. Recent years have seen the continuing apotheosis of the singer, dubbed La Divina, during her lifetime. The mounting tributes are testament to the enduring breadth and depth of the Callas legend. Hundreds of books in dozens of languages explore every detail of a complex, eventful life. Recordings, good and bad, continue to be rediscovered, remastered, repackaged, and re-released as every advance in technology attempts to capture the real, unvarnished voice of Callas. Exhibitions abound, devoted to the photographs, costumes, fashion, and jewelry that show Callas after her notoriously punishing regime of weight loss in perfect tune with the style of the 1950s and 60s. Callas's life and art have been captured in plays, films, and documentaries, portrayed by performers as diverse as Meryl Streep, Fanny Ardant, and most recently, Marina Abramovich, whose Seven Deaths of Maria Callas toured the world before arriving at English National Opera earlier this season. In this work, the celebrated performance artist portrays Callas on her deathbed in Paris, revisiting her life through the alter egos she inhabited on stage, exploring the notion of immortality through art. Today's great opera singers continue to pay homage to their inspirational idol. One memorable example is Angela Georgiou's 2019 solo album homage to Maria Callas, the cover of which features the Romanian diva made up to look like La Divina. Perhaps, though, the most extreme example of Callas veneration to date was her reincarnation as a hologram. Indeed, a three-dimensional replica of the singer, computer-generated from film footage of her performances, was taken on a world tour in 2019. The ghoulish experiment served merely to demonstrate the limitations of virtual reality. The New York Times described the show as more like a séance than a concert. Meanwhile, the tributes keep coming. At the Cannes Music Festival this year, it was announced that the Chilean director Pablo Larraín would be filming a new biopic focusing on the singer's final lonely years in Paris before her death in 1977. Larraín already has experience in this genre. His biopics include Spencer, about Princess Diana, and Jackie, a portrait of the woman who proved to be a nemesis of Callas in the doomed love triangle with the Greek shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis. The new film, whose release date is yet to be announced, is entitled Maria and stars Angelina Jolie. A centenary is an occasion for celebration, but it's also an opportunity to grasp the roots of Callas's genius and what made her unique. In a 20-year career, Maria Callas changed the world of opera profoundly. Her approach to bel canto singing enabled audiences to rediscover the power of composers such as Rossini, Donizetti, and Bellini, whose operas were regarded in the early 19th century as lightweight baubles, devoid of the emotional depth of their romantic and verismo successors. Of course, there were great singers preceding Callas, who displayed many of the vocal pyrotechnics and luster of La Divina. In fact, Callas emerged from a long line of great singers who helped construct the image of the early 20th century operatic diva. The histrionic virtuosity of Luisa Tetrazzini, Amelie de Galicucci's prowess in the recording studio, and the heart-on-sleeve pathos of Claudia Muzio all provided essential ingredients in the alchemical mix that resulted in the phenomenon known as Callas. In the October 12, 2023 edition of the Guardian newspaper, Kate Connolly interviews Joanna Malwitz, the new chief conductor at the Berlin Konzerthaus. For months, Joanna Malwitz's image has been plastered on billboards throughout Berlin, heralding her arrival as the new chief conductor at the Konzerthaus. She is, they proclaim, the next big thing. A virtual unknown figure in the Berlin capital until recently, the musician says she can no longer go to the supermarket or local bakery without being recognized. The build-up was massive, says Malwitz, who was inaugurated last month. I had to push it all away from me, saving myself, as it were, by concentrating on getting to know the musicians, or on how I wanted to conduct bar 17 of a particular symphony. It is with a certain unease that Malwitz seeks to explain the enthusiasm with which her appointment has been received. There is her youth. Having started her career at aged 19, she is now aged 37, by far the youngest music director to lead a house in Berlin's teeming classical music world, which boasts 7 large orchestras and 3 opera houses. There is also the fact that she is female. In the more than 300 years in which the city has proved its global status as a thriving and influential music center, her appointment marks the first time the top job in a leading Berlin orchestra has been given to a woman. "This is of absolutely no relevance to my work," she says, approaching the issue with caution. "When you're standing in front of an orchestra, you're only concerned with one question. Does it work or not? It's what a conductor's life depends on." On the other hand, Malowitz is quick to say she's not realitätsfremd, out of touch with reality. "I realize there is still the need to talk about these matters. The perfect situation would be if we arrive at a place when it is no longer interesting to even ask me the question." The comparisons between Malowitz and Lydia Tarr, the chief conductor of a large Berlin orchestra played by Cate Blanchett in Todd Field's psychodrama, have been rife. There have even been references to the supposed targeting of Malowitz by the Konzerthaus's publicity team. She elegantly dismisses them. "I know it's ridiculous. I really want to see the film, and I adore Cate Blanchett. But it's been such a whirlwind, I've had no time. But the comparisons between me and her, well, it's just the hair, right? To be honest, people have been saying to me for the past 20 years that I and Blanchett look a little bit alike. And, you know, I'm sure she has no clue about me." Friends, perhaps the same ones who says originally tried to steer her away from the Shark Tank world of conducting, have told her enough about the film for her to ask whether it's actually a good thing to be compared with a fictional Tarr, a haughty, paranoid autocrat. In contrast, the musicians who work under Malowitz talk of her lack of hubris. "Absolutely modest, completely subservient to the music," is how one harpist from Nuremberg's State Theater describes her. When Malowitz left as general music director after 5 years at the Bavarian city, 65,000 people attended an emotional open-air farewell concert in July. Not generally known to eulogize, Berlin's music critics have been unusually effervescent. The reviewer of her debut Konzerthaus performance in the Berlin tabloid BZ described her conducting style as high voltage, her interpretation of Prokofiev as refreshing, raw, risk-taking, and said she had unleashed the galloping youthful furor of Kurt Weill's Berlin Symphony, her dance-like movements suggesting she was strung with elastic. The Süddeutsche praised her ability to plumb the emotional depths of the music. Der Spiegel has described Malowitz, just 3 years old when the Berlin Wall fell, as the antithesis of the antiquated image of the maestro, embodied in such towering figureheads as 80-year-old Daniel Berenbaum, whose resignation for health reasons as general music director of the Staatsoper, after 30 years, caused shockwaves across the classical music community. And his recently announced successor and former rival, 64-year-old conservative heavyweight Christian Tilemann. Diplomatically adept, she responds, "You know, There are also so many other people out there, men and women, who are a counterpoint to the antique maestro. She has congratulated Telemann, she says, recalling the joy she felt as a student 2 decades ago in Berlin of slipping into his rehearsals, and those of the city's other great conductors, like Sir Simon Rattle, and realizing their own counterparts were in the stalls watching them. I thought, this is amazing. This sort of support, comradeship, and exchange, which is what makes this city so rich. It's wrong to talk of rivalries. You can learn something from everyone, and everyone is very different. It's a privilege for me to be a small part of that now. At the same time, she says, it's no longer enough to say I'll don my dress coat, take to the stage, bow, direct my symphony, and expect people to be drawn to the concert hall. It would be presumptuous to think that's the case. She wants to reach people who don't know how passionate they might yet be about classical music, because they haven't necessarily experienced it yet. Her trademark so-called Expeditionskonzert format, in which, together with the musicians, she takes the audience on a journey through a piece of music ahead of a concert, are sell-out events, and her own way of communicating her passion for the music. She recalls being 16 and seeing a performance of Igor Stravinsky's Le Sacre du Printemps, or The Rite of Spring. She got hold of the score and brought it into school. I was floored by it on a complete high. And once I told my friends, they were suddenly all into Sacre. On a recent Sunday afternoon, she sat on the edge of a piano stool on the stage, describing to the captive audience of a packed concert house the huge scandal the charmingly dissonant work had provoked at its 1913 world premiere in Paris. Stravinsky, she explained, had finished composing it under the influence of unbearable toothache. It hasn't lost any of its power, she tells them. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.